morning. Welcome to this month's Hancock Horizon Investments Economic Update call. Hancock Horizon Investments provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions, please email david_lundgren@hancockhorizon.com and he'll take them at the end of the call. On today's call, we have investment directors Greg Hudleski, Richard Chauvin, and Jeffrey Tangus. Our moderator will be David Lundgren and Chief Investment Officer. And with that, I'll hand it over to David.
Great. Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to our annual year-in-review market outlook for 2017. And before we get started, John Portwood sends his apologies. He is under the weather and wasn't able to join this morning at the last minute. But we're going to move forward without him, and he'll be back with us next month. So what I'd like to do is kind of figuratively walk around the room and reflect on 2016 and just ask the group, what do you think the biggest headliner of 2016 was? And I'm actually going to jump in front of the line and tackle the low-hanging fruit. I think the obvious big headline for 2016 was the U.S. election. And it's really bigger than that. I think it's also the anti-establishment populist movement that's taking place across the world. Europe, most of the West is experiencing some form of anti-establishment populism. And what's, I guess, interesting or sort of surprising about it is that many of the experts and polling information has really missed the mark in regards to this movement that's underfoot. And I think that's sort of made for an interesting storyline in 2016. It started with Brexit, and there's a lot of similarities between Brexit and the U.S. election just by the fact that it was, you know, pretty clear amongst the media and the experts that the vote was going to go one way, and it went the other. And both of the polls had missed the outcome by a good 3 or 4%, and that led to a surprise because I think a lot of people depend on that polling data and, you know, again, sort of missed the mark. So I kind of think that was the biggest headline of 2016, and I'm going to throw it out to the rest of our panelists, and maybe we'll start with you, Jeff. What do you think outside of the U.S. election? What do you think was the biggest headliner of 2016?
Well, clearly I think one of the biggest stories is going to be the U.S. dollar, what people have come to refer to as King Dollar. We added on another year since 2011 of significantly stronger U.S. dollar trading versus virtually everybody else in the world. When we look at just what happened in 2016, our currency was up about 3.5% versus the major trading companies, countries around the world, about 4.5% if you throw in a lot of the emerging market countries that had very weak currency. So our dollar continues to be the preeminent currency in the world. Wasn't that long ago that people were kind of predicting its demise and saying the euro would take over or the Chinese yuan would take over, but the dollar continues to surge, and by all estimates thinks that it's going to keep going up. The reason that the dollar was so strong is, of course, fundamentally our economy is the best in the world. And it looks like it may be getting better if some of our pro-growth policies and government stimulus kick in. That's probably the biggest reason. Secondary to that, our interest rates are significantly higher than everybody else in the world, certainly all the developed countries that are investable. So we have good interest rates. We also have stability, you know, Brexit and the possibility of the Eurozone breaking up. That makes our currency even more attractive. Our politics are relatively stable, even though some people would argue with that right now. I think historically you would say that we're stable from a political standpoint. Our markets are liquid. They're transparent. So we just have a lot of good things going on the currency front. And it looks like 2017 will be more of the same. It's great for consumers. It keeps inflation down. Unfortunately, it's bad for manufacturers who are trying to export because it makes our products more difficult to profit on the world markets. But generally speaking, the dollar has had a phenomenal run, and I think that's one of the biggest stories for last year.
I think I read 14-year high. Does that sound right?
That's right. That's exactly right.
Amazing. Yeah, that's definitely a big headliner. Greg, what do you think? Biggest headliner of 2016?
I think I couldn't really point to one thing that bothered me, but I think there were multiple headlines over the course of the year that really almost drew a conclusion in my mind that this was probably one of the strangest market environments we've ever had. And if I had to assign a personality profile, I'd say it was kind of manic depressive or bipolar disorder. We started the year with this abysmal outlook basically by all market participants at the beginning of the year, and by the end of the year we had this 180-degree turn, and it's amazing how attitudes changed in such a short period of time, because at the beginning of the year, the price of oil was in a free fall, China's rate of GDP growth was slowing from double digits to single digits. We continue to have hand-wringing over the Federal Reserve policy and when are they going to do the tightening, how much monetary tightening are we going to get, and in what period of time. Political campaigning was in full swing, and, of course, that always fosters a feeling of uncertainty in an election year. And generally, investor sentiment, along with the general outlook of most businesses, that things are pretty dismal. Then as we kind of approach spring, and, you know, we had the all eyes kind of turned to the British referendum on whether to leave the European Union. And as you correctly pointed out, polling suggested it could be a very close vote to leave, but common sense would, you know, eventually prevail in Europe, and then ultimately the decision would be to stay in the EU. And, of course, the final vote to leave the European Union surprised the pollsters, the media, and the politicians. But basically the message was the people said we're tired of the status quo. And the amazing thing, and as you kind of reflect back on the past year, is that that seemed to be an isolated event at the moment. And I think it's a little bit more permeates globally, rather, as we saw in the election in the U.S. And then, of course, you know, the resulting vote of Brexit sent fears of more economic disaster, you know, global recession, stock market turmoil. But in the end, it was a very muted response. I mean, we had a couple of days, I think maybe about a week of stock market selling off, and then things turned around. And then finally, of course, as we headed into the fall, finally eyes began to focus on the U.S. presidential election and the inherent uncertainty about an election year, regardless of who's running. But much like the British referendum, the polling suggested a much assured Clinton win over an unpredictable Trump, discounting the fact that Trump prevailed over all other Republican opponents. So I guess to me, it was the product of all the headlines, of all that turmoil last year that just had this really almost impossible to predict. I mean, markets are impossible to predict anyway, but it was particularly difficult last year.
Okay, all good points. So, Richard, we have populist, anti-establishment movement, king dollar, bipolar markets and world. Can you top that?
I don't know if I can top it. Some of what I have to say maybe ties a few of those things together. Certainly my topic, I think, is a direct result of the election. And my point, I think, that to me marked a real shift this year was a refocus on fiscal policy prospects in the future as opposed to monetary policy, which we have been fixated on since the crisis in 2007 and 8 and the recovery beginning in 2009. Everybody's talked about monetary policy. Monetary policy has been expected to save the nation's economy, Europe's economy. It's been asked to do far too much and more than it's capable of doing. So fiscal policy has been a missing element in any of the discussions about how to solve our low growth, somewhat stagnant economic situation. now with the new administration coming in, the House GOP has a plan that they would like to put in place. President-elect Trump has a plan he would like to put in place. They both involve significant fiscal policy changes. I'll get more into the details of that a little later in this call, but I think the focus in the future over the next several years, as this gets debated and enacted in some form, will show that that monetary policy will take somewhat of a backseat to fiscal policy as a driver of economic growth in this country.
Yeah, definitely a theme as we entered the fourth quarter that became more prevalent. I'm really surprised that no one talked about energy. And Greg, you talked about the bipolar markets that we had over the course of the year. And when I think back to January, February, when oil was hitting multi-year lows, there was talk of significant bankruptcies within that particular industry, recession as a result. We had a significant market sell-off. I kind of think that fits in at least one of the categories or top five of biggest headliners for 2016. I don't know if anybody has any other thoughts on that.
Dave, I'll just add to that. One of the things I think that might occur, first of all, as a result of some stability and maybe a little bit of potential upside in energy prices, even from here in the low to mid-50s, is that an improvement in business confidence that could come from the rhetoric that we hear out of the administration and the fact that the Republicans have all three branches, the Senate, the House, and the administration in one camp, is that capital spending could ramp up, and that could certainly benefit the energy industry.
Absolutely.
And I might also add that, if you remember when we were peaking out in the price of oil, everyone was worried that it was raising costs for businesses, particularly transportation, trucking, that it was, crimping profits. And then when the price of oil came down, Wall Street was basically saying, look at it's a implied tax cut. This is a really good thing. But then as oil kept on falling and falling and falling and falling, all of a sudden what was initially thought to be a good thing that was going to help cost structures in corporate America became a bad thing. And, that's the multiplier effect of economics where at some point it becomes less profitable to do different types of energy exploration, production, refining, and you begin to lose businesses. And so what you do is if you have a reduction in consumption overall in the economy and it begins to put businesses out of, obviously bankruptcies and put businesses or at least reduced revenue from their general businesses because they can't do as much anymore because other firms are going down. So there were some peripheral companies totally unrelated to energy or services to the energy service companies that their revenue was affected because of the energy industry and because of the decline in oil. So that's a big key point.
Thank you,
yeah,
Greg.
Dave, I'd add one or two little things to the oil story because I think it certainly is one of the amazing turnarounds of 2016. And I keep up with what's going on out in the Permian Basin, West Texas, and I'm seeing articles that the drilling activity is just picking up dramatically out there. They're finding oil in places that nobody has ever even drilled or they had any idea. Some people have even called it something of a bubble out there with the production and the drilling increase, the rig count increasing, and even read some articles that if some of the experimental drilling techniques pan out there, that they could get oil prices, they could produce oil that is competitive with the Saudis. That's a phenomenal thought. Just to even mention something like that is incredible, but there are some great things that are happening in oil and gas right now, and it's a far cry from where we were 12 months ago when it was all doom and gloom.
No doubt. So we've tackled the easy part. We've been able to reflect and talk about what's happened. So now the hard part. next year when we have this call, let's try and, if we can, think about or talk about what we think the pressing issues during the year are going to be. So, Richard, I'm going to start off with you.
Yeah, to me, this is an easy one, Dave. And it doesn't get a lot of attention because of some of the other things that have happened to kind of swing the confidence pendulum over to the right with lots of enthusiasm, a market improvement that started in November right after the election. The thing I think that I'd like to focus on and have the listeners focus on is that Donald Trump has always been a protectionist. He professes protectionism. He has nominated or selected people to his inner circle that have protectionist tendencies with regard to trade. He has threatened companies and countries with trade protectionist threats, such as recently with Toyota. He mentioned to Toyota over his Twitter feed that they would be subject to a big border tax if they produced cars in Mexico in the future, as opposed to building another plant here. He said that NAFTA, we will either renegotiate NAFTA or we will break NAFTA. NAFTA is basically a free trade agreement between North American nations. I don't know what renegotiating it means when it basically took tariffs down to basically zero. So renegotiating it seems like you could only go backwards, not forwards. I don't know how you could improve it from the point of view of trade. So I think this is something that investors should focus on and probably will, but what's unknown is whether these statements in these selections are more of a negotiating tactic to show our seriousness about protecting our industries and workers, or whether there will actually be significant action taken to protect our industries. I think the thing that should be worrisome to people if they look at history is that any type of initial action regarding restrictions on trade or tariffs, additional tariffs, always are met with retaliation. It's always a zero-sum game. You can never come out ahead. Basically, the global economy will suffer for it. Economic growth will decline. Trade will decline. Look back beyond our lifetimes, before our lifetimes, obviously, to the Great Depression, which was significantly hampered or worsened by the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, which have a lot of similarities to the kind of talking that's going on now with regard to protectionism. And they were enacted in 1930. Gross domestic product dropped by a third in this country over the next several years, and in 1934 they were repealed. So they were a complete disaster. So hopefully these are negotiating tactics and not serious talks about introducing major tariffs or restricting trade, because if they are, there's nothing good going to come from it. So I think that's a major point.
I do, too. I agree. That is a significant issue for 2017, and I think is somewhat getting overlooked. Greg, what do you think? Pressing issue for 2017?
Well, I think certainly everyone's eyes have been on the stock market, and we had some debate on previous calls about whether the market's rise was purely as a result of the results of the election or whether there was something else going on underneath that. And rarely in the investment environment can you really point to one thing. I mean, it's human nature to kind of try and focus on, you know, why did the market sell off today or why was it up today, and to assign one single point. And it's never really that easy. It's really a confluence of a lot of factors that are going on that are in many ways more difficult to predict than the weather. But I think a combination of positive economic numbers that have been coming out had certainly something to do with it, and we touched on that, I think, on last month's call, that with the revision, multiple revisions of the third quarter GDP raising above 3%, you know, that was a positive. Because the market actually started turning up prior to the to the election day, it was already turning around, and I don't think it was in any anticipation of who might win because, again, the polls were pointing one direction and the reality was the other. But I would maybe rephrase the entire question on whether, you know, companies can deliver on market expectations, because I think that's really what's on everyone's mind, that the market's gotten so far ahead. And if you don't have the underlying economics or fundamentals to support that, then we really just further inflate a potentially overvalued or richly valued market. But I think I would rephrase it to, can consumers deliver the consumption that will boost earnings and revenue that ultimately will support the market gains that we've seen and the expectations? I think that the administration's agenda for tax and regulatory changes, and, you know, we're really, it's defined where less is better. So lower taxes, less regulatory changes, and I think that's particularly going to affect the oil industry and probably some of the environmental regulations should be lessened. And I think a lot of companies feel like they're overwhelmed with an over-regulatory burden, and we certainly see a lot of that in the financial business. But I think if that can get enacted, that should help lower the cost structure and some of the onerous regulations, and that should provide a tailwind to corporate profits, which, again, that's what we want to see. We want to see corporate profits going up. We want to see earnings growth, and, again, that's going to support improved valuations. I just read some recent research by Bank of America Merrill Lynch that suggests that earnings revision ratios, and that's where analysts are writing up earnings as opposed to cutting earnings estimates, that they're improving. And they're increasing rather than, you know, cutting projections. And this is not only necessarily for the U.S., but globally as well. And the other suggestion also is just, you know, again, looking at on the bond side, typically there's been some debate whether the shape of the yield curve really is indicative or predictive of economic growth or decline. But in general, historically, the yield curve shape, if it's flattening, tends to portend a recession. If it's positively sloped, which it is now, tends to indicate that the bond market is seeing further growth and strength in the economy. So I still think that the probability is that we are going to see improving numbers, and this touches a little bit, this next comment, on what Richard has been talking about. The substitution for monetary policy, which really we've been overly reliant on, and I still remember back in 2000 after the tech bubble crash, there was a phrase called pushing on a string. And, you know, it was at some point, how low do you lower interest rates? I mean, we talked about negative interest rates in the beginning of the year. And, you know, it just doesn't seem to have ignited the economy. So this shift towards a fiscal policy stance, it's going to be interesting to see if this really does do something more impactful to the overall economy. And I guess and that's something that Richard could maybe comment on, whether he's got a feel for how soon something like that can actually be enacted and implemented. And I think that's going to be a crucial point to see whether the markets and the economy meet investor expectations.
Expectations are clearly high, and I do agree that's going to be a significant issue for 2017. You know, can companies and to your point, consumers deliver on those expectations along with government? I think that's going to be critical. Jeff, how about you? Pressing issue for 2017?
Well, in my world, it's clearly how will investors cope with rising interest rates? We've seen rates generally declining now for 20 years or so, and that in July of 2016, it looks like we reached the inflection point. Part of that inflection point was a function of Federal Reserve and central banks around the world using monetary policy to lower interest rates, trying to juice economic growth. And as Greg and others have just pointed out, we seem to be switching from a monetary approach to a fiscal approach, which means spending money and probably in all likelihood borrowing that money to spend in different fiscal programs. That in all likelihood leads to reflation of some sort, takes deflation off the table, and starts to see some pickup in inflation. This, of course, translates into higher interest rates. higher interest rates on the short end will be rising because the Federal Reserve really wants to raise. They want to get out of the near zero interest rate policy on the short end. And of course, the market will take care of the longer end by just adjusting rates and buyers being pickier about what they'll settle for and demanding higher rates along the way. So that's what investors, in my mind, are really going to have to contend with, because a fair amount of most people's balanced portfolios still contain a significant portion of bonds. And so how are they going to deal with this? And you look at the tools that are available, you can, A, invest in shorter maturities that are less sensitive to changes in interest rates. That's one way to be on the defensive. You can invest in corporate bonds or municipal bonds, taxable or tax-free. Either of those offers some incremental yield over traditional treasuries. That incremental yield helps buffer the decline in price as rates rise. You could also look at other things like floating rate securities as well as TIPS, treasury. Inflation-protected securities that build in a buffer against rising inflation. So there are multiple tools to be used, all of which just mitigate the effect. For the most part, you can't avoid the impact of rising rates, but you can mitigate the impact. So how investors choose to deal with this will probably still be, is yet to be determined. We need to see the policies that are going to come out of the new administration to understand exactly how much stimulus, how much reflation is going to come out of the equation. But I think it's already baked in the cake that that is the direction that things are headed for 2017.
I agree. Thank you, Jeff. And I'll just throw in a couple more pressing issues. If you've been a regular or even occasional listener to these calls, you've heard John Portwood talk about this new normal economic environment that we've been in really since 2009, where we've seen this 1-2% economic growth for an extended period of time. And, you know, I think a real question is this the year that we escape? And as we enter 2017, a lot of economic indicators are more positive. We talked about there's generally a better tone and more confidence amongst consumers and businesses, that potentially could propel things higher. We have a strong labor market, which is also another positive. And as we've talked about quite a bit, I think people are confident because the potential for tax reform and regulatory relief are high priorities for the Republican-led Congress and administration. Those all could potentially lead us to where we get out of this 2% economic growth that we've been in for an extended period of time, and we move into, you know, more of a 2.5 or 3% GDP world, which would be back to even, you know, closer to, you know, historical trend line. Obviously, as we've also discussed, there's quite a bit that needs to be overcome. You know, Jeff talked about rising rates and rising inflation, and then Richard talked about trade issues. Those all, there's a delicate balance there, and those risks could weigh heavily to where we fall back into that 1-2% world. So I think, you know, one of the pressing issues is can we overcome these hurdles that are present and finally, you know, get back to a more normal economic growth environment. And I'll just touch on this other pressing issue is I'll talk about it in a little bit, the need for Republicans, a lot of whom ran on a platform of reducing the deficit, how do they balance tax reform and the desire to reduce the deficit? That is going to be very interesting to see how that plays out going forward. So with all that said, let's go ahead and shift gears a bit and kind of talk about markets. And we traditionally just really talk about stocks and bonds. I think this year we want to change the focus up a little bit to include other asset classes. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Richard. And Richard, if you could kind of talk a little bit about what were the best and worst performing asset classes in 2016?
Yeah, sure will, Dave. I'm going to break this up into the three categories, look at some of the fixed income asset classes, the equity asset classes, and I'll even talk a little bit about some of the alternatives that are out there that we follow and we'll be using more in the future. First of all, in fixed income, the big winner by far in fixed income this year was high yield. High yield bonds, sometimes known pejoratively as junk bonds, had a great year. They earned 17.5% return in the well-known indices. That's basically due to not so much their coupon, which was often quite high, but in this low-rate environment, it's probably only been around 5 or 6, maybe 7%. But the spreads narrowed dramatically as views of the economy improved, and that meant capital gains in those bonds, so a high double-digit return and high yield for the year, which was amazing. Funds, are otherwise known as bank loan funds, earned 10.16%. Again, that's sort of the same trend that drove high yield, drove floating rate. Emerging market debt, despite all the concerns about emerging markets and China's slowing, emerging market bonds earned 9.94%. A little lower on the U.S. Side here, U.S. corporate bonds earned 6.1%. Still not a bad return in this environment. Down at the lower end, global bonds, excluding U.S., only earned a point and a half, 1.49 to be exact. U.S. Treasuries earned only 1.04. Again, starting with a low coupon, and then we had rising rates, as you know, later in the year, took away that capital gain, turned it into a capital loss, so we eked out about a 1% return in treasuries. And finally, most disappointingly, I guess, municipal bonds in general did poorly. The municipal bond index that we follow earned 0.25%, so basically a flat year in munis this year. Again, pretty disappointing to a lot of our investors. Moving over to equities, small cap was a big winner. Again, it was a risk-on environment, an environment where risk was rewarded this year. So small cap earned 21.3% this year. That's U.S. small cap. Value funds outperformed growth. Value was up 17.3%, whereas growth earned 7.08%, so a pretty big spread there, about 10% spread between value and growth. The well-known S&P 500 index had a good year, 11.96% return. We would not have expected a double-digit return this year, and we got it, so we're very pleased. And finally, in equities, international equities, that excludes U.S., earned only 1% this year. So the U.S. was the place to be in equities for 2016 for sure. And I'm going to go over to alternatives now. A couple of alternative investment categories that we follow. Master limited partnerships, which are mainly pipeline companies that carry energy and resources throughout the country, earned 13.3% this year. Pretty good number. Commodities in general did well, up 9.79%. Some of the metals in particular did well in 2016. And I'll wrap it up and say the long short equity category, which is one that we actually have internally, was down this year 4.25% as a category. So that's the only loser I've reported in this mix of asset classes that I've mentioned. So that's a wrap-up on asset classes, Dave.
Okay, great. Thank you, Richard. I'm going to go ahead and talk just a little bit about the year in review for the stock market, and then we'll go ahead and talk about our outlook for 2017. Richard talked a lot about the major averages and how they performed during the year. One thing that I think was really interesting about the year is that as of February 11th, so we got out the gate, with a very, very rough start to the market. The S&P 500 was down 10.3%, and the Russell 2000, it's really amazing to look at this. It was down almost 16% as of February 11th, and then proceeded, the Russell 2000 proceeded to bounce 44% off that low to finish the year up 21%. So it was really an amazing turnaround, and a lot of that happened in the last 6 weeks of the year. So really good. You know, when you think back to February, it didn't even look like there'd be a chance that we'd get into positive territory, much less double-digit returns for the year. Also of note, the S&P 500 equal weight, for the first time in a long time, outperformed the cap-weighted index. It was up 14.8%. Value outperformed growth, 17.4 versus 6.9. So pretty big differential for value there. And then lastly, from a sector standpoint, again, another amazing turnaround story. Energy actually was the top-performing sector, up 27.4%. And, you know, back in January, February, energy had continued its downward plunge that it had been on for really almost 2 years, and then proceeded to go up 50%. Off of its January low. Another unloved sector that was in the top three was financials. Financials have had a rough go for a few years. It was up 22.8, and the other top-performing sector was telecom services. The bottom three, not too much of a surprise here, generally more defensive sectors, consumer staples, real estate, and healthcare, all finished in the bottom three, with healthcare being the only negative performing sector. It was down 2.7% for the year. So, but all in all, a really strong year for 2016. Let's just shift gears and kind of talk about our outlook for 2017. And as we've done in past years, John Portwood has historically given the bearish case, and Greg has given the bullish case, and then we try and pull them all together. And because of John being out sick, you know, Jeff made the joke yesterday, nobody gives the bearish case like John Portwood, but I'm going to do my best to kind of make the bearish case for the market in 2017, and then we'll hear from Greg. And really, I think there's four major points, and we've really touched on a lot of them. Regardless of politics, we're entering an environment of tighter economic conditions. I'm going to talk about each one of these in just a second. I do think that there's a chance that fiscal policy disappoints. Concerns about trade and the dollar are another point that could weigh on stocks in the given year, and then valuations. I think that's the fourth major point that really build the case for a difficult or negative year for stocks in 2017. And let's talk about the tighter economic conditions. There's obviously a lot of optimism about tax and regulatory reform, but regardless of politics, I think we're sort of potentially at a turning point for the economy. And it really, you know, has a function of higher interest rates and a tightening Fed. You know, and Jeff will talk about it in a minute. I think we're looking at the Fed increasing rates maybe two or three times. And while we're close to all-time lows on interest rates, we're still much higher than we were 6 months ago. And we've seen a significant move up in mortgage rates. Mortgage rates are at a high that they haven't seen in almost a year and a half. Historically, that's weighed on consumer spending, so that could be a drag. And then, you know, over the last several years, businesses have chosen stock buybacks and dividends with excess cash, and I think there was some hope with that new confidence that we'd see increased spending or investment by businesses. I think we'd run the potential of that being muted by being in a higher rate environment. So I think that also has the potential to weigh on stocks. In terms of fiscal policy, and again, this is where all the headlines have been. I think this is part of the reason the market has performed as well as it has the last few weeks, last 6 weeks really since the election. But I'm concerned, you know, that there's going to be some disappointment. And if you look at tax reform first, and I mentioned it earlier, you know, the Republican Congress really has a focus on deficit reduction. I think that's going to tie their hands some to do anything that's meaningful from a tax reform standpoint. I think that's going to be disappointing to the market. I think expectations are high. And even any kind of tax reform, all of the discussion is not necessarily for it to be retroactive. So anything that does get passed may not go into effect until 2018. And there's also some talk that it's going to be phased in. So, you know, the potential for an immediate positive impact from tax reform, I think, is going to disappoint many. And then from an infrastructure spending, which we've heard a lot about as well, I think this is also going to disappoint, because more than likely you're looking at the budget passing mid-year, and then by the time projects actually get started and get underway, the real economic impact from any sort of infrastructure spending won't be until 2018 and beyond. So I think fiscal policy, you know, has the potential to disappoint. The third point, and again, we've talked about it a little bit, is concerns about the trade in dollar. The higher rates have contributed to the dollar hitting the 14-year high. This is going to hurt earnings, especially amongst many of the large multinationals that make up a large percent of earnings for the S&P 500. Additionally, we talked about the potential protectionist views of President or President-elect Trump. This is a big concern, and it could be quite disruptive. And we need to figure out what's reality and what's just rhetoric. So time will tell, but that does have the potential to move the market negatively. And then lastly, valuations. When we started this bull market run that we've had going back to 2009, we were looking at valuations in the low double digits, say somewhere between 10 and 12. 65% of the market move that we've seen since that point is a result of multiple expansion or price-to-earnings ratios going higher. And, you know, you've heard the term price to perfection. I think it really is appropriate. And I do think that if any of these other risks that I've discussed at this point come to fruition, this market that's priced to perfection, instead of being at a 17 or 18 multiple, you may see that number come down, which could result in a bit of a negative market or negative environment for stocks. So I'll end the bearish case there. And that now that I've depressed everybody, Greg, now how does the market overcome these risks? What's the bullish case for 2017?
Well, before I start, just ironically, Donald Trump just tweeted me, and he wanted to know why you were throwing up obstacles prior to his inauguration. I told him to be patient, but I those are all very valid points, and I think you lightly touched on the one crucial fact. And as I talked about before, there's a very complex set of data and decisions and inputs that drive investor expectations and market expectations, and it all comes down to timing. And all those points are valid, and I think some of the points that I'm going to touch on here in a second are all valid also. And it all comes down to the mix of timing and when those things are implemented and when they're, you know, if they're pushed back. And so that is really, I think, the whole point that can jeopardize the success or failures of policy. But I guess from the bullish case, one, I'm just looking at, and you shouldn't look behind, but again, to touch on the third quarter GDP with the revisions being up over 3%, you know, that was a positive, and I think, again, that was one of the drivers that has been propelling the stock market, not necessarily just the election, but I think also the election, to the sense and to borrow the, you know, previous Barack Obama's hope and change, I think Trump just promised another hope and change. If you want to use, sometimes people use the analogy of ice cream, you know, and I think both the Democrats and Republicans have basically been kind of selling us the same flavor of ice cream, just different ones, for quite a while. And I think Trump came along and said, you know what, here's some Rocky Road. I've got a new flavor of ice cream. And I think you know, that played into that populist attitude. So I think that was also kind of a positive impetus for the markets to rally a bit. PMIs, or the Purchasing Manager Indexes, and we've talked about those previously, and that's basically there's a couple of different surveys that look at corporate purchasing, investment, hiring, business conditions, and all of those have generally been very positive lately. And I think last month I kind of touched on, I'm hoping that that's not just a peaking in PMIs, but actually a continuing trend. So those have been strong, and that implies that businesses are seeing future growth. So I think that's a second positive out there. That would support, you know, higher GDP numbers. And, you know, of course, in the coming weeks, we'll see what the fourth quarter finally turned out to be. So that is a positive. Investor confidence, which we've touched on, and also investor confidence turned up, which doesn't necessarily guarantee a positive outcome. But I think the willingness and the more hopeful attitudes of both investors and consumers is a step in the right direction, again, in total contradiction to what we saw at the beginning of the year. So with that in mind, just having that more positive outlook could, you know, make reality happen, or at least kind of a Pygmalion effect, where if you believe that to be true, it eventually becomes true. Probably the fourth thing, I think, the Fed is also dedicated to raising interest rates. And from a historical perspective, interest rates are still extremely low. I know we talked about mortgage rates being up and that interest rates are going up and that the Fed is going to raise rates. And that was a lot of debate over the last 2 years on what's going to happen. A lot of people just assumed that that was going to cause the market to crash or to decline because of rising rates. But if you look at some of the research by Ned Davis, one of our research providers, is historically stocks have actually done better in a rising rate environment than they have in a declining rate environment. And if you think about it in that sense, it's going to be the Fed will not raise rates if they think that the economy is going to falter. So generally, the whole case for raising interest rates by the Federal Reserve is that the economy is on firm footing, it's doing better, earnings growth is strong, and that will allow them to raise rates and actually contain inflation going forward. So I think that's another positive. And then just from the simple cost structure standpoint, even a few more interest rate increases will still allow companies to have very favorable and very cost competitive financing going forward for quite a few years, unless things really take off and that all of a sudden becomes very expensive globally in terms of financing. And again, counterintuitively, rising rates always don't spell disasters. I said just simply because the Fed, I think, is seeing something out there that gives them confidence that the economy is going to be on firmer footing. And as long as earnings and revenue growth are strong, they should overcome any detrimental effects of rising rates and improve the valuations or price-earnings ratios. As you pointed out, PEs are very high. The other thing that I might point out, though, is that historically, if you look back at a chart, and we've talked about this also on previous calls, that PE ratios are inverse or move inversely to interest rates. So as interest rates go down, PE ratios tend to go up. So it's not unusual from a historical perspective to have high PE ratios in a very low interest rate environment. And again, just following this forward or following this logic forward, as interest rates go up, correspondingly, you hope earnings will go up. And as earnings go up, that PE ratio actually does come down. And so you would see PE ratios become more normal, or even, you know, if earnings growth was incredibly strong, it would actually become undervalued, if you can see that, but that's hard to envision at this point. So I think those are really kind of the positive aspects out there. But again, you know, which of the ones prevail or which points that you bring up or which points that I bring up, it's all a matter of timing at this point.
Okay. Great points, Greg. And I guess really to kind of wrap up the bullish case and bearish case to our thoughts from a firm perspective, I think you need to kind of establish a base case and understand that, you know, there are many different scenarios that can play out that will
move one way or the other from your base case. But I think our base case basically is that we're looking at a bit stronger economy in 2017 than we've seen historically, and a little bit better earnings growth than we've experienced the last couple of years. But in terms of valuations, I think the likelihood of multiples expanding further is unlikely. Therefore, the market return for 2017 is going to be pretty heavily dependent on earnings growth, which leads us, you know, somewhere in the mid to high single digits as sort of a base case or best guess. Anything you want to add to that, Greg, before we move on to bonds?
No, I think that's a great summation.
Okay, great. Jeff, sorry to leave you at the tail end here, and we're really going long on time, but maybe if you could real quickly, what's the Fed going to do, and where do you see interest rates going in 2017?
Well, you know, the Fed, we've learned to ignore much of what the Fed says, but for some reason, I think just experience tells me that they're going to be a little bit better about following through on their promises this year. The Fed has talked about 2 to 3 increases this year. I think if we're right and we get some stimulus and we get some of the economic growth and we get some wage inflation and some other modest inflation, I think the Fed will get 3 increases done this year. But whether it's 2 or whether it's 3, that's sort of trying to fine tune things a little too much. The direction is what really counts, that short rates are headed up. Longer rates are likely headed in the same direction, assuming we're right about inflation again. So the bias is up on short and long end. I think the other aspect of that is, given that, what are the better places to invest? And I think I touched on them briefly, floating rate type securities, inflation protected securities. I think high yield will have another relatively good year, actually, because it behaves a lot like stocks, and I think stocks will be better than bonds. And finally, municipals, which were hit pretty hard this year because of all the talk about Donald Trump's tax reform and a decline in income tax rates, those all are negatives on munis. I've been doing this for a long time. I've seen people predict the demise of the muni market, and it never has come to pass. And I think this year, although there might be some nibbling around the edges, I think munis will once again survive and will be one of the better performers this year, actually, after having sold off pretty dramatically this year.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Richard and Greg, and thank you, everyone, for joining us this morning. Covered a lot of ground. Our next month's meeting will be on February 7th. Please join us then. Thank you.